loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia accidentally revealed yesterday that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange has been indicted in the district, and the indictment is sealed. Assange's name was accidentally included in an unrelated terrorism and child pornography case. Next, an announcement by North Korea that they have developed an unspecified new tactical weapon is causing controversy. The Hawkish Center for Strategic and International Studies think tank said this week that they had discovered 13 supposedly secret North Korean missile development sites. President Trump, however, said that he's known all about the sites for a long time. Is the intelligence community trying to sabotage the Korean peace talks? Then, regional leaders gathered in Singapore this week for the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The intense competition for influence in the region between China and the United States was fully on display at this high-profile gathering. And then 631 people are now missing and 66 are dead in the devastating California wildfires. Thousands of other people are living in tent cities after their homes were destroyed. Meanwhile, President Trump said that he will visit California tomorrow to inspect the damage. This was after he tweeted that the fires were the fault of California's Democratic elected officials. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Julian Assange. A federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia accidentally revealed yesterday that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange has been indicted in the district and the indictment is sealed. Assange's name was accidentally included in an unrelated terrorism and child pornography case. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World: How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, John.
Dan, I'm really troubled by this whole thing. What happened was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of Virginia accidentally revealed that Julian Assange has been charged with, we don't know what, at least one crime. It's probably espionage or something akin to espionage. The charges have been sealed. And then when a reporter realized what had happened, the reporter went to the judge and asked that the charges be unsealed. The assistant U.S. attorney responded, and I have a quote here, "Due to the sophistication of the defendant and the publicity surrounding the case, no other procedure is likely to keep confidential the fact that Assange has been charged. The charges need to remain sealed until Assange is arrested." What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not surprised. I think we've suspected for years, and certainly Assange himself has, that the U.S., if it hadn't formally charged him, certainly was interested in doing so and interested in apprehending him. And that's why he's remained in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. But, you know, now that we know this for sure, it's quite upsetting. And, you know, I think people of goodwill need to move to defend him, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. I tried to dash off an op-ed today as quickly as I could, and I make a couple of points in this op-ed. One is that, unfortunately, the prediction that many of us have made that Julian would be charged in the Eastern District of Virginia is true. The Eastern District of Virginia, and I've said this before, is known as both the Rocket Docket and the Espionage Court because no national security defendant has ever won a case there. So his chances of acquittal are slim to none. Secondly, he will likely be in the courtroom of Judge Leonie Brinkema, who reserves all national security cases for herself. She had my case. She had Jeffrey Sterling's case. She reserved the Ed Snowden case. She did Zacharias Moussaoui. She takes all these cases for herself, and she's a hanging judge. I recount in this op-ed that at one point, as I was approaching trial, my lawyers filed 70 separate motions to have 70 classified documents declassified because they were necessary for my defense. We blocked off 3 days for the hearings, and we walked into the courtroom, and Judge Brinkema said, "I'm going to save everybody a lot of time. I'm going to deny all 70 of these motions. I don't think that any of the cables are necessary for your defense." And that was it. It took a minute. So we walked out of the courtroom, and as we were walking out, I said to my attorney, what just happened in there? And he said, we just lost the case. That's what happened. And I fear that Julian is going to go through the same kind of experience where he's just simply not going to be allowed to defend himself. And remember, the Espionage Act has no proactive defense. You can't plead not guilty to espionage because you did it for the right reasons. And that's why both the Obama and Trump administrations have used the Espionage Act as an iron fist to clamp down on dissent. So how do you think, you're an attorney and you're a human rights expert, how do you think that Julian could best defend himself under these kinds of strictures?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult. I mean, I guess, obviously one is he isn't a U.S. citizen. So, you know, he's not going to be subject to a number of laws that could otherwise be brought against a U.S. citizen for sedition. You know, he doesn't have any loyalty to the United States. So by definition, it would be hard for him to have been engaged in treason in that sense. But I am, you know, so that will be certainly something he will raise. I think the other thing he will try to defend himself on is that probably all the documents he has publicized, he has not himself taken. Right. So someone else took these documents, who had access to these documents, and sent them to Assange. His only crime is having put them on a website. Now, why is that a crime? And again, the irony here, or the hypocrisy, is that outlets like the New York Times, for example, tend to call for his head, while at the same time they cite WikiLeaks all the time for their stories. Mm-hmm. How is it that they're not also guilty?
Yeah.
Of the same crime that Assange would be guilty of, right?
Is there any legal difference there? I don't see one, but maybe I'm missing it.
I don't think so. You know, and that's where it becomes very troubling. You know, and this has been a critique, of course, of the mainstream media's coverage of Assange and WikiLeaks, that they are more than happy to profit off of telling tales from WikiLeaks while at the same time trying to vilify and demonize Julian Assange for having set up WikiLeaks. So, but this is called prosecutorial discretion, right? And they will go after low-hanging fruit, people that can't defend themselves or people that they think represent a threat to the system. And I think that's really what Assange represents to them, and I think that's why they will go after him.
We're speaking with Dan Kovalik from Pittsburgh. Dan's a human rights and labor lawyer who's the author of the book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Dan, I want to ask you about jury nullification. And I know it's a dirty little phrase. You're not supposed to talk about it. But I wonder if jury nullification is a viable strategy for Julian were he to go to trial in the Eastern District of Virginia. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I think that is always a tactic that defendants can use. Yeah, and I think for those of us who are more defense-minded anyway, I don't think we view jury nullification as a dirty word. Again, yeah, we wouldn't say it openly, but the idea that a juror too could vote to acquit, even if someone was technically guilty of a crime, but they think that the person was justified in doing what they did, for example, or were furthering a greater cause. Again, things that you could think about Julian Assange. The idea that a juror could acquit based on those considerations is frankly something that's built into the system. I mean, that is part of what a jury is for, not only to look at the law, not only to look at the facts, but to make a judgment about someone's culpability based on their own conscience. And so that is certainly something that could be done here.
When I was in trouble, Dan, and heading toward trial in the Eastern District of Virginia, I engaged a jury consultant. And it was the same jury consultant that O.J. Simpson hired. And he also worked for George Zimmerman and William Kennedy Smith and a bunch of other high-profile people going on trial. And he flew up to Washington to speak to me. He did it for free, too, because he just happens to be the uncle of my best friend's wife. So he came up here and got a security clearance and went through all the documents. And I'll never forget, he looked me right in the eye and he said, If we were in any other district in America, I would say, let's go for it because you're going to win. But in the Eastern District of Virginia, your jury is going to be made up of people who are with or have relatives with the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, intelligence community contractors. He said, I'm sorry, pal, you don't have a chance. Do you think that Julian is going to face the same kind of jury? Is there any reason why he wouldn't?
Well, I mean, again, one of the jobs of a good defense lawyer is to try to weed out the worst people from a jury. Maybe he could get some luck ending up with a halfway decent jury. Or again, that one juror who may acquit. But I think that, you know, given the demographics of Eastern Virginia, that may be difficult.
Yeah, I think you're right, unfortunately. I wish that there was some sort of good news. I wish there was some angle to this story that we could point to and say, well, at least there's this. You know, at least there's this hope or this chance. And I just can't come up with anything.
I have a ray of hope.
Yeah, tell me. I'd love to hear it.
Well, that is, it looks like Theresa May's days could be numbered as prime minister. And I think if Jeremy Corbyn were prime minister, he would not turn Assange over to U.S. authorities, you know, and that may be the only hope that he has.
I think you're probably right. We're going to have to end it there, though. We were joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor attorney who is the author of the new book, The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. An announcement by North Korea that it had developed an unspecified new tactical weapon is causing controversy. The hawkish Center for Strategic and International Studies think tank said this week that they had discovered 13 supposedly secret North Korean missile development sites. President Trump, however, said that he's known about these sites for a long time. Is the intelligence community trying to sabotage the Korean peace talks? We're joined from Columbus, Ohio by Gregory Ehlich. He's a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea and the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me. Nice to join the show again.
We're happy to have you. A couple of interesting things here. First of all, let's talk about this new tactical weapon. It was funny to me. It really does appear to be tactical. It appears to be a multi-firing artillery weapon, which means that it doesn't violate any agreement that North Korea may have with anybody, the United States or South Korea, yet it was front page news in the American papers. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a good deal of speculation about the exact nature of it, but as you say, it's clearly a tactical weapon, artillery related, which means it's entirely irrelevant to the subject of denuclearization agreements. In fact, it's not only not part of an agreement, but there's also no UN resolution banning North Korea from developing a tactical weapon. I think the Washington establishment is grabbing at straws, anything they can to try and sabotage negotiations between the U.S. and North Korea. And in a case like this, it's irrelevant, but it's not portrayed as irrelevant. So they're trying to frame the whole issue that North Korea can't be trusted. Look at they're developing this weapon, new weapon. It's a complete fabrication of the issue.
Greg Ehlich is our guest. Greg, this is a pretty remarkable double standard, right? I mean, the United States military has by far, by like a lot, by multiple times, the largest military budget in the world, well over $600 billion. They're constantly developing new weapons. They have the most advanced military industrial complex in the world, but we never see headlines about, oh, Pentagon unveils dangerous new weapon, right? I mean, when we do see headlines about it, it's about, you know, it's laudatory. It's about how cool and great they are. Remarkable, isn't it?
It is remarkable. And if you look at U.S. Department of Defense documents, they're talking about trying to enhance the lethality of their weapons. And they're constantly developing new weapon programs and firing off ballistic missiles, too, which is something that they condemn North Korea for doing. I'd like to point out also that if you take into account that U.S. nuclear weapons program is actually funded by the Department of Energy, and you combine that part of the Department of Energy's funding with the Defense Department funding, as well as the operations in Iraq, which I believe are still off the DOD budget. The U.S. is spending more on the military than the rest of the world combined. But as you say, it's a remarkable double standard. North Korea, the entire GDP of North Korea is actually less than Vermont, which ranks last among U.S. states. The imbalance is quite extreme.
Well, speaking of missiles, I mean, CSIS came out with this new report. They said, you know, they've uncovered these secret hidden missile bases in North Korea. And that generated headlines. I mean, that was big news in the United States. Tell us your thoughts on that, you know, revelation or maybe not so new revelation.
Yeah, so if you look at the Center for Strategic International Studies report, actually most of the report is just describing the buildings that they're identifying the various photos. The photos, by the way, are from March 29th, which is prior to the June 12th summit between Kim and Trump. So I think it's irrelevant whatever activities they say are going on. But even then, they're saying that they're just showing the last 5 years shows only minor infrastructure changes to the base. These bases that they claim to have identified 13 bases. These are nothing new. South Korea and the United States Intelligence Service are both saying that they've been aware of these for some time. The report claims that these are undeclared missile operating bases. Well, North Korea has no obligation to declare its missile bases. It's never agreed to do so. That has yet to be negotiated. And in fact, no nation has an obligation to declare its missile bases to the United States. So that's a complete red herring in that particular issue that they're raising.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you about that because that's what struck me when I read these reports this morning in the Washington Post and the New York Times. Why is this news? The North Koreans are not under any obligation to report these issues to the United States or the United Nations or any other body. So why is this news?
I think the Washington establishment is actually the New York Times report kind of hinted at the concern when they quoted Victor Cha, who is actually a senior advisor and Korea chair at the CSIS, and he said, "What everybody is worried about is that Trump is going to accept a bad deal. They give us a single test site and dismantle a few other things, and in return we get a peace agreement." And of course, what's wrong with that, right? The U.S. would only have to acknowledge that, yeah, the Korean War ended 65 years ago, and in return, North Korea dismantles part of its program. I think the Washington establishment is in a bit of a panic because, let's face it, Trump is extremely unpredictable. You don't know what he's going to do. And they're worried that he won't stay with the program of basically imperialist confrontation and pressure, and that he might actually negotiate a peace and denuclearization agreement with North Korea that would be fair-minded. Of course, that's not the approach Trump is actually taking. Trump is demanding that North Korea completely denuclearize without receiving anything in return except additional sanctions. Even so, the Washington establishment is still in a panic that he might settle for something more reasonable.
Yeah, and Donald Trump actually did come out and publicly address these reports saying that, well, look, I mean, we knew about these. This is not news to us. But it is really remarkable, his turnaround, because, you know, when he was addressing the United Nations, I mean, you could argue he basically threatened to commit genocide against North Korea, right? He said, "We will completely annihilate you," or something to that effect, or totally destroy, you know, something that, like, a really unprecedented threat at a venue that's supposed to be about peace and diplomacy. But then, you know, less than a year later, just a few months later, he's initiating these, well, he's not really initiating them, but, you know, he's participating in these historic peace talks. What do you attribute that turnaround to?
I believe it was actually mostly due to Kim Jong-un determination to try and change the direction of relations between the United States, because let's face it, it couldn't go much farther down the path it was going without a tragedy arising. So he made unilateral concessions, and South Korean President Moon Jae-in was receptive to some of these contacts from North Korea, including North Korean delegation to the Olympics. So anyways, North Korea has made some pretty significant unilateral goodwill gestures without receiving anything in return. So, for instance, it's implemented a freeze on nuclear tests and on missile tests. It's destroyed its nuclear test sites, so it can no longer conduct any nuclear tests whatsoever. And it's in the process of dismantling its Soha missile launch site. So I think that North Korea presented Trump with the opportunity to actually achieve denuclearization, and he took it. You know, it's basically North Korea put this on the table and said, here, we can give you everything you want if you want to, if you're willing to talk about it.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And now, there's talk about another high-profile summit like the Singapore summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un coming
up. And what would be accomplished at a summit like that? It seems like we took this giant leap forward, and then we've taken a whole bunch of little steps backwards since the Singapore summit. So at another summit, which the president keeps talking about happening in the relatively near future, what would be accomplished at something like that?
Well, that remains to be seen, and I imagine that there are behind-the-scenes talks going on to prepare the way for that. Right now, there's a basic stalemate because the United States is not willing to relent on easing on sanctions. In fact, it's talking about adding more sanctions and has continued to add more sanctions to North Korea. And it's Trump and his administration, officials like Bolton and so forth, are saying that no sanctions relief is in store for North Korea until denuclearization is finally complete. But that's a non-starter as far as North Korea is concerned. It wants a step-by-step process of mutual actions. So you give us something, we give you something. So I think the summit is hopefully going to iron out that discrepancy between the two approaches. Otherwise, this is not going to go anywhere. And one of my concerns is that, as the New York Times report indicated, the North Korea has yet to take the first step toward denuclearization, which is providing a list of its nuclear sites. Well, nobody said that's the first step. That's yet to be determined what the first step is, but the Washington establishment is insisting that North Korea has to identify all of its sites, and North Korea is reluctant to do so because once it does that, that would allow U.S. military to plot the bombing coordinates of each site. Well, without the United States supplying a security guarantee in exchange, I think North Korea would be foolish to make that as a first step. It needs some kind of security guarantee that's in place or nearly in place before it can reveal where each of its sites are at.
You get no disagreement here. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Columbus, Ohio by Gregory Ilitch. He's a member of the Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. And he's also the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Regional leaders gathered in Singapore this week for the summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The intense competition for influence in the region between China and the United States was fully on display at this high-profile gathering. We're joined from Singapore by Niall Bowie. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times, who was on the ground covering the ASEAN summit. Niall, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Great to be back.
Niall, this hasn't gotten a whole lot of press in the United States. Can you give us an overview of what's been happening?
Sure. So as you said in the intro, I was covering the ASEAN summit in Singapore this week, which brought together leaders from the 10 members of ASEAN. So that's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the regional grouping of Southeast Asia, along with leaders from Russia, China, the US, Japan, India, Australia, and New Zealand. So President Donald Trump was not present, and Vice President Pence was sent in his place. So when Pence was en route to Singapore this week, his aircraft flew within 50 miles of Chinese outposts in the contested Spratly Islands in the South China Sea. And he said this was a type of a freedom of navigation exercise. That's a clear message to China that the U.S. wants to show that it won't be intimidated by Beijing, which is regularly warned against U.S. operations in areas it lays claim to in the South China Sea. We've seen tougher rhetoric and action from the Trump administration over the last year. The U.S. Navy has more frequently performed freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. China has, in turn, recently deployed missiles and other advanced military assets to outposts in the sea, which are basically small islands built up through land reclamation. So this week in Singapore, these ASEAN leaders did register their concern over these developments, as well as concerns on the economic front. Both the U.S. and China have introduced tariffs, which are a big concern because Southeast Asian economies are very much a part of the supply chains that are affected by those tariffs. And ASEAN countries are increasingly worried that the great power rivalry we're seeing will lead to the formation of rival blocs that will force them to choose sides, either with China or the United States. And leaders in Southeast Asia have been increasingly frank and candid about this. These countries don't want to join any antagonistic alliance, and yet we see Washington is ramping up pressure on them to stand up to China or get out of the way effectively. And this is being done under the auspices of America's new Indo-Pacific strategy, which is the successor policy to the Obama-era pivot. So the big difference was that Obama's policy had an economic offering. That's a Trans-Pacific Partnership. That was a multilateral trade deal that would have incentivized American companies to diversify away from China in favor of other Pacific Rim economies, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, and others. You know, Trump pulled out of that deal during his first week in office, and his policy has replaced that trade deal with a trade war that has very, very similar goals in mind, if you ask me, and that's to cut China out of supply chains, you know, unless it grants major concessions, basically greater market liberalization and moves to reduce the trade deficit with the U.S. But in the midst of this trade war, ASEAN countries have sided with China because they see Trump as embracing a kind of unpredictable brand of protectionism and being cool to the kind of multilateral approach to trade that previous administrations have upheld. And in the meantime, China has played its cards very adeptly. It's cast itself as a defender of free trade. It's pushed ahead with its Belt and Road Initiative, which is a trillion-dollar infrastructure plan involving dozens of countries. It's about major cross-continental infrastructure links. That's new bridges, roads, ports, railways, and motorways to connect the Chinese economy with the greater Eurasian landmass. So in conclusion here, Southeast Asian countries have been very supportive of this Belt and Road Initiative. Generally speaking, we have seen countries like Malaysia question some of the high costs and economic viability of certain projects. But here, during this trip, we saw Mike Pence, and he is expected to elaborate more during the APEC summit this weekend in Papua New Guinea. He's going to elaborate a little more about the economic aspects of this Indo-Pacific strategy. At the same time, the U.S. administration has been openly criticizing the Belt and Road projects as being debt traps. So we have a lot of moving parts to this, a lot of things going on.
We're speaking with Niall Bowie. Niall is a journalist with the Asia Times, and he's joining us from Singapore. Niall, you wrote an article in the Asia Times in which you sort of recapped the Singapore presidency. This is a rotating leadership of ASEAN. This year was Singapore's turn. They are turning over the reins to Thailand. And you point out that this was kind of a rough year for ASEAN. There was a lot of trouble in the region. There were many disputes. You have the United States bumping up against the Chinese and the North Korea, South Korea thing. Do you see this getting any better in 2019, or do you see the U.S.-China competition just getting worse?
Right. Okay. So it was a pretty tough year. I'd say the grouping kept it together fairly well. But what we saw compared to recent years this time around was a big emphasis on trade and multilateralism. Basically, we've seen free trade agreements such as the CPTPP, which is the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So that's a new version of the TPP that the countries that were involved before went ahead with and joined, you know, have ratified. That's after Trump pulled out. So we have that going, and we also have another negotiation for RCEP, which is a massive free trade deal. That's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which involves several different countries, all of ASEAN, plus China, Japan, India, and a few others. So it's a massive trade deal. So we have a lot of cooperation on free trade, and the U.S. isn't at the table on this. In other areas, we see over the past year, one of the modest accomplishments was the fact that Singapore was able to push ahead and what's called the draft document for the Code of Conduct. So the Code of Conduct in the South China Sea what this document is, it is sort of a legally binding code to regulate security protocol among claimants in the South China Sea. So, you know, a lot of countries in Southeast Asia claim parts of this sea. And what I see going ahead is that the U.S. is going to put pressure on ASEAN not to acquiesce to Beijing with respect to the code of conduct, the negotiations that are supposed to come together within 3 years. China has said within 3 years they want to clinch and agree on a final code of conduct. And just for some reference, it's been 16 years that they've been negotiating for the draft document that will set the stage for further negotiations on the code of conduct. So people are a little skeptical of whether this code of conduct will actually come together in 3 years. But from what I can see, it's pretty obvious Washington doesn't want China's claims to be acknowledged. China does claim about 90% of the South China Sea as Chinese territory. I mean, you can look at their map of the region. It's what they call the nine-dash line, which encircles almost the entire sea, which is, of course, quite acceptable to everyone else. And as I mentioned, ASEAN countries also claim those territories. So I don't see them acquiescing, but I do, truthfully, I do see them kicking the can down the road with more of these slow-moving negotiations. And I think they will continue to go ahead and deepen economic ties with China in the hope that Beijing won't go and occupy any other features where it's not currently present.
That's the voice of Niall Bowie. Niall is joining us from Singapore. He's a writer and journalist with the Asia Times. He was on the ground covering the ASEAN summit. Niall, we have 2 minutes left. Mike Pence flying deliberately into or close to, I should say, area that's claimed by China, both the sea and the airspace. It's labeled a freedom of navigation event. That's a euphemism. It's really in China's face. And we have this at the same time that the U.S. has revamped its national security strategy, identifying great power conflict, meaning between the United States and China and the United States and Russia. But I think principally China as the priority for the Pentagon, not the war on terrorism in the coming period. Can you envision a period or an event triggering a major power conflict? I mean, we had World War One that ended 100 years ago. We had World War Two. Are we going down that road once more? 1 minute left.
Well, it's a hot spot, no doubt. The biggest harbinger of instability in this situation would be those provocative military maneuvers in the seas, either by the U.S. or China. The U.S. appears to have every intention of challenging China's claims through these freedom of navigation operations, as you mentioned. It's a euphemism. So there's a risk that this turns into a game of chicken where someone's challenge line is crossed and bullets start flying, at which point you have a major crisis that would send markets into a tailspin and, you know, divide the region into rival blocks, as some of these ASEAN countries have warned against. So skirmishes in the sea, in my opinion, I think even if they're really even if relatively minor, you know, the new Cold War gets a few degrees hotter if it gets to that. And it's a big danger for everyone. And it really ought to be avoided.
That was Niall Bowie, who joined us from Singapore. Niall is a writer and journalist with the Asia Times. And he was on the ground in Singapore covering the ASEAN summit. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. 631 people are now missing and 66 are dead in the devastating California wildfires. Thousands of other people are living in tent cities after their homes were destroyed. Meanwhile, President Trump said that he will visit California tomorrow to inspect the damage. This is after he tweeted that the fires were the fault of California's Democratic elected officials. We're joined from San Francisco by activist Sheila Zhao. And we're also joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back, both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to be here.
Happy to do it. Sheila, let's start with you. The president is going to be in California tomorrow. He ridiculously threatened to cut off federal payments to California just a few days ago because he said that California's elected officials and state appointed officials, poor management was the cause of the fires. He tweeted that. He did not delete that tweet. What kind of a reception is Donald Trump going to get in California tomorrow?
I think it's going to be kind of a sentiment of, you know, resentment, and kind of it's insulting, right, for him to say something like, oh, you know, all the wildfires are due to gross mismanagement. I think anyone who has been paying attention to the natural disasters knows that this is, you know, a climate crisis. We know that this is a result of climate change, right? You know, and I think for him to say that and then all of a sudden be like, oh, I feel so bad for all the victims of the fires, it's just insulting, right? This is obviously a photo op for him to posture as if he cares about the victims of the fires. And we know from the history of, you know, the past 2 years of his presidency that he doesn't really care about human lives, right? What these people need is direct aid right now, shelter now, and a guarantee that they'll have housing and not just some photo op that Donald Trump, you know, is coming to California for. And that's what the people want. They want us, you know, security to know that, you know, they can move on with their lives past this devastating fire.
Walter, I'm looking at a piece in National Geographic that is chilling to me. It says that 10 of the 20 hottest years in the last 125 years have been in the last two decades in California. So it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter. This chart shows that it's getting drier and drier. And indeed, in Los Angeles today, they have 7% humidity. I mean, I would expect things to just start to spontaneously combust at 7% humidity. Talk about the role that climate change has played in these fires, not just the fires that California is going through right now, but over the last decade or two.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is like an existential issue for every human being on the planet. You know, there's the UN climate change scientists report. You know, some of the top climate scientists all around the world got together under the auspices of the United Nations and said that, look, by 2030, if we don't make drastic changes to the way that we produce and consume energy, then there's going to be irreparable damage done to the planet, and that's going to have that's going to cause mass displacement, especially of people who live near, you know, low-lying coastal areas, which is, you know, a huge chunk of the world and disproportionately poorer people. You know, and this outbreak of horribly deadly wildfires, I think, is one of the symptoms of this global catastrophe that the United Nations is warning about, and so many scientists and activists have been warning about for decades, really. I mean, the world has known about climate change since the 1970s, the 1980s, but there's this unmitigated greed, I think, by especially by the oil and gas sector that just wants to, you know, ignore it for the sake of profits. And yeah, I mean, California is getting drier and drier and drier and hotter and hotter and hotter. And that means that even though there are sort of naturally wildfires that happen, right, it gets so much worse as a consequence of this phenomenon.
Sheila, in this National Geographic article, it says that just based on climate change, an area of 10 million square acres has burned in California in the last 20 years. That's the size of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. That's an area that has burned that otherwise would not have burned had it not been for climate change. So what at a state level, is there anything that the state can do to try to mitigate some of the damage or to better prepare for the future? Or is this just overwhelming?
You know, that's an interesting point because, you know, I've grown up in California all of my life. And so I grew up in San Francisco, but now I live in Los Angeles. And this week I've spent the week in San Francisco. And just to kind of give you an idea of what it's like to grow up in California, right? In the midst of all of this, right? Every year of my adult life, the news headlines have said, you know, each year it's like we've seen broken record of heat during the summer months, right? And so what I think is obviously, you know, the state needs to take some sort of preventative measure to protect people of California of these fires. I mean, they're increasingly predictable. We know that it's going to happen. It's inevitable, right? With climate change, with the heat, and just with the devastation that we've seen the past 2 years. I mean, even this week in California, or in San Francisco in particular, which is 160 miles away from the Paradise fires, the air quality index has been far above what's considered healthy. And to kind of give you some context of what that is, so an AQI between 0 to 50 is considered healthy. Anything between 51 to 100 is considered moderate. And anything between 101 to 150 is considered unhealthy to sensitive or at-risk groups, so people who have respiratory issues, elderly people. And this week, San Francisco has been far above 150 threshold. And yesterday, the AQI was 235, which is astonishing. And, you know, people have been taking it upon themselves to buy masks, and not just any masks, right? These are like construction worker grade masks. And really, no one should be walking outside without them. But the city hasn't done anything about it, right? And the city really should be distributing these to the public so that people have access to this, right? Just for basic health reasons. And so my question is, you know, really, why hasn't the city or the state done anything to protect the people? I think the one thing I could say is that the district in San Francisco did cancel school. Kids can't go to school today because the air is so bad.
Wow. You know, there was another thing, too, that actually it was Walter that pointed this out to me earlier in the week, and that's the advent of private firefighters that fight fires only for the wealthiest people. There's an article in the Atlantic Monthly magazine talking about a home in Calabasas, California, owned by Kanye West and Kim Kardashian, where private firefighters, apparently in the employ of the insurance company, went out to battle the fire and actually saved their house where other houses in the area were burned. This is something that only the wealthiest Americans can afford. And it sort of exposes this fault line between what the rich have and what everybody else has. Well, what everybody else has is their house turning to ash, but the wealthy get to keep their houses. Is this a new phenomenon? Is this California specific? Or has this been going on a long time and we just haven't heard about it?
I have to believe that this has been happening for a long time, right? I think that these fires have drastically exposed the massive inequality we see here in California. But I think it's a, you know, nationwide issue. Like, just like any natural disaster that happens in the U.S., wealthy people are able to evacuate, to pay tons of money to take preventative measures, right? To pay for, expensive insurance plans that most people don't have access to and can't afford. And it couldn't be more clear that only the rich can afford really to protect themselves. Meanwhile, the rest of us, right, we watch our homes burn and we slave away to pay for these homes, right? To make our monthly mortgages, to pay our bills, just to watch them burn. And we don't know, a lot of us who have lost our homes, we don't know if we're going to be able to rebuild our homes, right? And I think that's the reality that most people face, that people like the Kardashians and other wealthy people don't have to think about, right? It's kind of beyond me that these insurance companies can advertise that we have, that they can provide private firefighting teams, right? That's just, it's just, you couldn't really hide just how stratified our society is, right? And it just exposes further that only the rich can really afford to live at this point. And I think it's increasingly true. And then you kind of contrast that to the farm workers in Ventura County who continue to work because they can't afford not to. And this is one of the things that the state should mandate, right? The state or the local county should put mandatory measures to protect the workers from unsafe working conditions. And that hasn't happened at all. And I don't know if you all have seen, there's this picture that has been circulating around social media of these farm workers picking food, you know, obviously food that we eat, on these beautiful grass fields. And it's contrasted by this like massive dark gray sky with like orange, right, from the fires. And I think that this picture contrasted with this article by The Atlantic about the Kardashians couldn't paint more of an accurate description of what it's like to suffer from these sorts of natural disasters under capitalism. A lot of us can't afford to safeguard ourselves.
Walter, we've got about 45 seconds left. What are the next steps here? We see these fires every year. What can be done to either lessen their severity or get people better prepared for the next time something like this happens?
Yeah, well, I mean, in addition to sort of the big picture changes, fundamental changes that we need to make to address climate change, I think that, you know, the two missing components are planning and resources. I mean, there needs to be some kind of standardized plan where everybody knows what the deal is. And, you know, the government, whether it's at the state level, the local level, the federal level, needs to provide adequate resources to make sure that those plans are able to, you know, take care of everybody.
We will leave it there. We were joined from San Francisco by activist Sheila Zhao, and we were joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. We're also joined here in the studio by Nicole Roussel. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
Okay, Steve, let's get started. You want to start with disgusting, misleading, wrong, dumb, funny? Where do you want to go?
Well, since I'm sitting here cooped up in the house and can't go outside because I can't breathe when I'm outside.
Wait a second. Where are you exactly and how bad is the air quality?
The air quality is really bad. The number is where I am, which is south of San Francisco, is 176, which is way above the healthy level. It's bad all throughout the San Francisco Bay Area now.
What is 176?
That's the air quality index.
You don't want to have 176 index. Whatever. No. We don't know what it means, but it's not good.
But it's bad.
No. Here's the stories that caught my eye about the wildfires, which don't have to do with the air quality. The first one's from the New York Times. Wildfires don't care about wealth or status. Miley Cyrus, Neil Young, and other celebrities are among the thousands affected. And then sort of the converse headline from the LA Times. It wasn't just the rich who lost homes in the Malibu area. Is fire California's great equalizer? And both of these stories reminded me of the famous quote by Anatole France, which I looked up to get the wording right, which it goes as follows. The law in its majestic equality forbids rich and poor alike to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal their bread. And this whole idea that wildfires are somehow equalizing the rich and the poor is just offensive in the extreme. In some cases, people may know, the rich actually have private firefighting services to protect their homes. And even if they don't, many of them, I mean, certainly Miley Cyrus and Neil Young and the other people in these headlines, they all have got, they've got second homes, third homes to move to if one of them burns down. 90% of their wealth isn't in the value of their home, unlike most people whose, again, the vast majority of people's wealth, if their mortgage is not underwater, is in their home. So the rich have countless other advantages. And the idea that somehow this fire, just because it's destroying the homes of some rich people and some poor people, is the great equalizer. It's just it's an offensive idea.
Private firefighters came out this week. We definitely saw those in California this week. I was completely shocked. I didn't know that you could privatize a basic resource like
that. But who are they? I mean, firefighters moonlighting as private firefighters for rich people?
I have no idea. And if there are people with these skill sets, shouldn't we just be adding those resources on to all of the, where they're most needed? Shouldn't we be adding these on to the fires where they're worst?
They're private corporations, private profit-making corporations, hiring themselves out to rich people to protect their homes. It's very simple, really. Just usual capitalism.
That's what it is. It's capitalism. Somebody found a niche and they made some money from it.
Disgusting.
It's awful.
Okay, let's go on. I'm disgusted now. Steve, I was worried in the last week, as I think most thinking people are, that the United States military has been in serious, serious decline relative to all the other militaries in the world. And I see you've selected a headline about just that.
Yeah, the Washington Post is a big story. They just never stop trying to get more money for the military. The headline, U.S. military edge has eroded to, quote, a dangerous degree, study for Congress finds. And it includes such lines as the United States has lost its military edge to a dangerous degree and could potentially lose a war against China or Russia. I'm not sure what war they're talking about. I mean, are we going to invade China or Russia? Is Russia or China going to invade the United States? I mean, I don't even know what war they're talking about. Nevertheless, the preposterous idea that the United States, doesn't have enough military capability.
I want to just ask, let's step back from the story, Nicole. The U.S. military's edge has eroded dangerously. The U.S. spends 10 times more than Russia on its military budget. It spends 5 times more than China on its military budget. The military budget of North Korea, and North Korea's military is significant, is the same size as the New York City Police Department budget. So how is it that the U.S. military, which is having gargantuan military increases, Again, the increase from the last year alone was greater than Russia's entire military budget. Just the increase to like $740 billion, an extra $70 billion more than Russia spends in a year. How is this possible?
It's eroded, Brian. I don't know what to tell you. We have a problem here in this country.
So you're taking their word for it.
I'm taking their word for it. You know, the thing that surprised me, I really thought when I read this headline, I thought it was from the Military Times. I swore that must be where it was from, not the Washington Post.
No, but that is, John, you know the Washington Post.
Sure.
The Washington Post, people say, is a liberal newspaper. No, it's not. Well, unless liberal means nothing.
No.
It's a neocon militarist echo chamber dressed up with that sort of like, it gives me the same impression as those NPR voices, those kind of professionally, I don't know, I don't even know how to describe those voices, but they're like real nice and gentle voices,
right,
but they're all about
like this.
Yeah. And it's like, good story. Great question. And it's always about defense of a constantly expanding military budget. The last time the United States mainland was invaded was the War of 1812. Anyway, go ahead, Steve. What's another headline?
We can go to another deceptive headline, which has deception in its headline, which was in the Times. In North Korea, missile bases suggest a great deception. Another article suggesting, you know, everything's going to hell in a handbasket. We better get ready to spend more on the military because we're, you know, North Korea is going to be attacking us now in addition to Russia.
But the great deception, let's just talk about what they say is what the article is basically saying when you read it. Is that the North Koreans have played Donald Trump and that they still have these secret military bases that are developing a missile capability, even though they've had a moratorium on missile tests. That's the great deception. Okay, I was in Singapore for the Kim Jong-un Donald Trump meeting. I read the communique. It doesn't say that North Korea has disassembled its entire military apparatus. There is no deception. The North Koreans and the United States began a process towards denuclearization, the first point of which in the communique in Singapore was that there should be normalized relations. Mm-hmm. In other words, peace. And that was the precondition for all other steps. This isn't a deception. There's no deception here. The headline is a deception.
Yes.
Yeah. And in fact, as another deception, which is so common, is the article talks about how the denuclearization of North Korea, but the communique, which you referred to, talks about the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, not of North Korea. It talks about, you know, denuclearizing the entire peninsula. They never mention that. So it's kind of, it's totally bogus and totally deceptive. And furthermore, they gave Trump an opening because Trump tweeted in response to this article that the U.S. knew all about these missile bases for several years, which was absolutely true. So by putting out this story, not only are they deceiving the American public, but they're helping to set up Trump and giving him an in to point out that the New York Times is propagating, you know, fake news, which they were.
And it had that same satellite imagery that reminded me exactly of Colin Powell's false testimony before the UN about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. We have 2 minutes left, Steve Pat. You know what? And our listeners are going to be shocked to hear this. Donald Trump does not actually know that much about geography or that much about history, and he doesn't know that much about Europe either. What's this headline?
Well, this headline reads, Trump confused the Baltics with the Balkans and accused confused leaders of starting Yugoslav wars.
Oh,
now,
God.
There's two remarkable things about this. First of all, of course, Trump is married to someone who's from the Balkans, and second of all, he was in the Baltics when he said this.
So the Baltics are Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, mm-hmm. by the Baltic mm-hmm. Sea, formerly part of the Soviet Union. The Balkans are Yugoslavia and that part of Southern Europe. Yeah, they were all the people listening to Trump were confused when he condemned them for starting the Yugoslav wars in the 1990s.
These leaders, these Baltic leaders looked at each other like, what in the world is he talking about? And then realized a minute or two into Trump's monologue that he had confused the Baltics with the Balkans.
Close enough. They both start with B-A-L.
It's just so embarrassing. Oh, my gosh.
But like Steve says, his wife is from the Balkans.
Yeah.
He doesn't know that.
He probably doesn't know
Slovenia
that.
Slovenia is part of the Balkans? Yugoslavia? I don't know. We have 30 seconds left, Steve Pat. What's the best headline here to take us out?
Okay. Well, here's a headline that probably will take everyone by shock. Exploding mojitos, the first sonic attacks targeting American diplomats in Cuba may have taken place 30 years ago. Why do we think so? Because an American diplomat was taking a mojito from his servant and the glass broke in his hand. And we're supposed to believe that was an attack by the Cubans. They've realized this 30 years later.
And of course, Donald Trump has used the mysterious attack, the sonic attack, still unproved, for American diplomats as the reason to do the thing that he wanted to do, which was to stop the normalization process between the United States and Cuba and intensify the economic blockade on Cuba. But that's all the time we have.
Well, until next week, gentlemen and lady, we'll leave it there. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area was Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefteye.blogspot.com. You can go there and see all the headlines that we didn't have time for. Steve also tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of the show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. La 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 la